invited us into their real home just down the street where they grew weed on their back porch and shared their love of Cornwall with me. We relaxed, played cards and took them up on their offers of rides, to the supermarket to make a Vortex supper and, for the boys mainly, a trip to a weed dealer who provided excellent homegrown bud. We girls all dyed our hair pink, something I had never done before, and the boys cooked our supper. We rested again for the day, and then we were taking our leave again, this time towards Mount Greylock. Deep, ferocious storms chased us from the mountaintop to the town of Cheshire on the other side, where a change of church management meant we were no longer welcome to sleep inside, as had long been the case. Instead, we made do with the stone-cold porch under a wooden portico, with Jesus sitting atop, welcoming weary travellers into the porch area only. We lasted a few hours on our mats and sleeping bags, leaning up against the church doors, enough time to draw the attention of a passerby, who stopped her car and ran over to give us all the snacks and food she had with her, explaining her father had hiked the AT in his youth and had a long, abiding love for it until he passed away. Dinner eaten, the mosquitoes were biting relentlessly, so we stirred from our half-slumbers just before midnight to pitch our tents on the sodden, boggy lawns instead. Better damp than eaten alive. The next adventures on our radar in Massachusetts were the Cookie Lady and Upper Goose Pond. Legend had it that en route to Upper Goose, you were to first find and visit the Cookie Lady, an older woman who lived just off trail and loved to chat, welcoming hikers through the season every day to eat her freshly baked cookies and share stories. Then, if you were lucky, you could pluck blueberries from her bushes and carry them with you until arriving, again slightly off trail, at Upper Goose Pond. Here a cabin stands, owned and run by the National Park Service and managed by the Appalachian Mountain Club volunteers through the season. They would lift the bag of blueberries from your proffered hands and welcome you to camp or bunk, joining others coming north or south. They would then use your travelling gift to provide you with delicious blueberry pancakes on your departure the next morning. And so it was that we arrived there with blue-stained fingers and a sopping bag of ripe fruit, pitched our tents and spent a blissful afternoon miles from anywhere, jumping off wooden docks into the still lake and borrowing kayaks to paddle around the central island. It couldn't have been more swallows and Amazons if it tried. I took my leave early the next morning, after the first pancakes, but before the majority of the site had mobilised. I didn't want to speak to anyone, revelling in the freedom and independence I was feeling and needing to keep that vibe alive, walking off the need to check my phone for text messages or Instagram likes. I realised that in the past weeks I had felt more distant from my previous real life, even though calls to family had been a little more frequent recently, as I reoriented to life in a new group. Whenever I felt a little lost, I needed to dip back into the pool of those who knew and loved me as a yardstick for who I was outside of this experience. This recalibration seemed important. It was easy to drift from oneself out here. It was also easy to imagine that the people and places I left behind were in stasis, preserved in amber, whilst I lived out this long pilgrimage not only in a different country, but what felt like a different dimension. Time was not marked out here by any more than the changes in the leaves. There was no news to follow, patchy service made any continuity on social media rare, and I was untethered to all the familiar trappings of my life. No gravity to me. Adrift. It was impossible to imagine things happening at home, because out here every day felt fundamentally the same. Find water, fuel the body, walk, sleep, repeat ad infinitum. I'd been walking now for over 2 months. My body was hurting, but in a normal way, the way that everyone's did at the end of a day. The more I was using my body across every plane of motion, the more it was giving me back in ease of movement. The more I trusted and leaned into its innate ability to know how to move and heal itself, the more it healed. all these years of believing my body had been doing me wrong, when really, perhaps, I'd been doing it wrong right back. I hadn't known what to expect when I called the specialists on that fateful night, when I hated my body and pain the most. That initial period in Italy, when I nearly shuffled myself off my balcony and this mortal coil. When I arrived at the clinic in Como, I was a broken woman, barely able to walk, holding walls for breaths and pain relief, so obviously unwell with deep black eye bags and pallid swollen skin. I didn't expect answers, but still had some tiny piece of me that wouldn't give up. In actuality, and to my eternal shock and later gratitude, I was presented with head scans, diagnosis, and possible resolution. When I was told that my teeth placement, the condylar head of my mandible on one side, and my overall bite was probably the root cause of my spiralling physical dysfunction, I initially wanted to scream. Another diagnosis. Another issue that could be the problem. I'd heard so many as to believe that no one knew a damn thing and everyone was a hustling charlatan. But on this occasion, I didn't really have any choices. When they described treatment, wearing a bite for months, changing the placement of my teeth, wearing braces for over 2 years, teeth implants in the bone, and the cost of it all, I was faced with a decision. If I believed them and ran with the new treatments, I would be in debt and risked another cataclysmic disappointment, which, despite having run on a big tank of hope and optimism for 10 years, I didn't have the reserves to face. How much energy did I have left to believe in another process? I knew by this stage that treatment alone wasn't enough. I had to be invested in recovery too. My other option was, of course, ending it all. I had broken down in the dentist's chair when the chiropractor and his dentist wife had presented all their findings. So I took my cue from the visible body's shaking relief I showed that there might be this other explanation for it all, that this might be the thing. I wasn't done yet. Debt be damned. I was never giving up. Over 2.5 years of rehabilitation and treatment followed. The process was slow and steady, and I regularly got worse before I improved. I soon moved from the care of the two leads at the Ritzy Clinic to work with the specialists in their team that I had been assigned to. These two incredibly kind men, another dentist and chiropractor pairing, became my friends. Over time, they both decided to leave the Como Clinic, and I elected to go with them to their new base. They kept my progress going and showed me extremely humbling levels of compassion, coming to treat me in my own home when I couldn't move because of pain, and assuring me that progress was not linear, that going backwards today didn't mean going backwards forever. And so it was that, in a job and country that were not perfectly suited for me, after a near life-ending moment on a cold balcony far from home at my lowest ebb, I found the men who saved my life. I had hope. I always had hope. And this hope, my parachute through the plummet of illness, had landed me in a foreign land and straight into the arms of my future via a card in my wallet and some talented folks who wanted to heal me. And now here I was, in that very future, leaning into my body and trusting that it knew how to heal and move forwards because it had proven it could do so before. But beyond the physical, my growing emotional independence on trail was highlighting how I had moved beyond my initial fears. This was reassuring, but I was proving to be like the proverbial onion, layer upon layer. One issue bubbled up after another, and all I had was time, forest, and my thoughts. It was really the best therapy I could have imagined, and the trees were great listeners, but I hadn't had the faintest idea I still had so much to learn about myself. I already knew I wouldn't be returning to life as it was before. I had no yearning for the busy that meant nothing except noise and empty peacocking, all to convince myself I was needed, important, and going somewhere. I could now see clearly that I had been going nowhere. Not so much a peacock as a chicken with its head cut off. Now I was actually going somewhere. My actions were meaningful, and this was borne out physically in the miles I earned under my feet and the blissful exhaustion of my body in my sleeping bag. Back when life had seemed untethered, I had instinctively known that walking would ground me, bring me back down from my state of me mania, and it had. Now I would have to try to keep hold of that grounding as I moved past this initial excited euphoria of the first part of the trail and into the green tunnel grind that was coming up. Connecticut, 51.6 miles. Chapter 13, A Collision with Real Life. Massachusetts gave me my first legal weed shop and THC gummies before it gently nudged me over into Connecticut. I wasn't sure I liked this state. Ritzy and glitzy houses tucked back from the roadside seemed to release regular drivers who would pass us with disdainful sneers as though we were vagrants or bums. Hiker facilities seemed rarer, and it was only when we arrived in my namesake town of Cornwall that things looked up, before they looked down again. Smudge and Captain had attempted to hike the Connecticut Challenge, 52 miles of the state in one day. They'd risen at 2 a.m. from our border camp at the edge of Massachusetts and set off with determination, Captain trying to resist the urge for a bucket bong before he left. Granola, Moose and I kept tabs on our buddies for this stretch, awaiting texts updating us of their progress. Ping! 10 miles done. Ping! 15 in the bag. Ping! 25! No problem. Crushed him before lunchtime. Then, disaster. A pulled muscle and the boys were holed up in a shelter down trail. We heard it from them and then from northbounders who kept us updated as they filed past. Your friends say hurry up. They want you to get there soon. They want some beer. Hey, are you friends with Cap and Smudge? They want to change their Connecticut challenge to the 24-hour challenge. 24 miles and 24 beers in 24 hours. They said they'll see you in town. And so we hustled to catch up with them. Granola and I were over CT and its ups and downs that looked so benign on maps, but in reality seemed unkind and pointlessly rooted over every lump and bump by the ATC just to wear us out. So, tired, we hit the road to town whilst Moose soldiered on through the trail proper in the high heat. More fool us, needing the head nets we'd given away for the first time since Maine. For the swarms of black fly that followed us so thickly down the hard top that we couldn't see any cars that came our way, let alone flag them down. Choking, coughing, and smearing scores of dying flies into our hair with every swat of our hands, we rued our decision to come out of the thickets. Eventually, a kindly older lady in a headscarf scooped us up into her fancy vintage automobile as though we'd walked out from the forest and into the 50s, and deposited us graciously by the gas station in West Cornwall, a home from home. The boys valiantly attempted the 24-hour challenge, but were thwarted by exhaustion. After our free beer each from Cornwall Packet Store for being hikers, we made our way to a state park by the river to camp together. The $7 fee a steal in order to have access to flat spots, showers, toilets, and charging facilities. Moose had been vomiting after arriving, extremely dehydrated from his last exertions into town with no water filter, Granola had it and she was with me, and drinking litres of water too quickly. He had been in a terrible funk ever since. Leaving him to his own devices, I joined Cap and Smudge with some beer shotguns, lining the 24 cans each for them along the picnic tables and wishing them well. After 3 or 4, Smudge slowed down, switching to spirits from his pack instead. Captain wasn't to be deterred and soldiered on, almost reaching 24, but not quite. The next morning, with the fog of aching muscles and hangover, he attempted to finish off the last three cans. But no sooner had he shotgunned the first than it made an immediate reappearance directly onto the floor at his feet. Fucking goddamn! He shook his head in faint disbelief that his youthful constitution had let him down.
Guess that's not gonna work.
And so we packed up camp to hit the cafe in town for breakfast. The tiny crossroads of a town greeted me with a coffee, some excellent breakfast bagels, and a text message from my dad about the death of a family friend. I burst into tears in the middle of chatter over the breakfast table outside the little deli, and on processing and chatting to Dad on the phone, I decided I just couldn't face hiking that day. Relentlessly walking day after day for so many months is exhausting, and psychic energy can be low at times. The news of the death at home had unsettled me, and I felt a wealth of other topics jostling up towards the crack in the surface it had caused, wanting to have their time in the sun too. Oppressed emotions surging for release. I wondered when my emotional well would finally run dry. I tried to hike, I really did, but our hitch back to the trailhead involved a conversation with the driver where my friend's death came up, and the lady driving us said that she'd happily drive me the 20 miles to the next trail town of Kent so that I could meet my friends there that night. Perhaps I'd like to spend the day in the local library, she said, emailing friends and taking my time to process things. I considered her offer. I also had a new pair of Altras that had been sent to the Kent post office for me some weeks ago, judged for exactly when I predicted my current shoes would wear out. If I dilly-dallied on trail today, with tears and tiredness, then I wouldn't get to Kent before the post office closed, and I'd have to wait until after 9 a.m. the next morning, when everyone else would have left camp for trail long before. Extremely inconvenient. I debated for a few more miles of hardtop, and then, when Cap and Smudge got out of the car to gather their packs from the trunk, I said I wasn't coming with them. They were happy to see me taking some time out, as 20 miles with a heavy heart is hard. So I waved them off and got back into the passenger seat to have my new guardian angel take me to Kent. It didn't take me long to realise that she was drunk. I mean, beyond hammered. Chattering about life, love and hard times, this woman in her late 50s was struggling to keep her car on her side of the winding leafy road, one hand gesticulating about this and that whilst the other only cursorily kept us right side up by dancing over the wheel. I gripped both sides of the car seat, wondering if in my teary grief I was overreacting. I hadn't thought I could smell alcohol, but occasionally I could. Something sharp and spirity, mixed with cigarettes and my own hiker stink. Perhaps it was medication, and I was poorly judging this kind lady, even after all she was doing to help me out. Who's to say? But most every muscle of my body was clenched tightly. I uttered a few oohs and carefuls whilst waggling my hand, before we arrived safely in the next town some 45 minutes later. She hugged me tightly goodbye and wished me well, commiserating me for my loss. As I waved her off back the way she'd come, I was grateful to her, but extremely annoyed with myself for staying in the car. Shoes collected and the old battered versions put into the bin, I shed my tears, called my parents, and set about catching up with all my email admin from real life on the library computers. Then, my work done, I ventured into the street to sit on a bench under some pretty trees and watch the townsfolk go about their day. Later on, I joined forces with Mike and Mia, his beautiful dog, and we headed back up into the forest to join our team of friends. New York, 88.4 miles. Chapter 14. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. The state of New York was a hot, dusty joy. Our abiding memories would be how parched we were, and that a deep desperation for running water and dripping taps began to conjure up fantasies of cold fizzy pop and ice lollies in our dreams. Alas, there were none. Streams were mud, springs were dry, and we were yet again relying on the kindness of strangers who would leave water caches at roadsides and behind walls and hedges for us to find. We were sparing, thinking of others, but it was hard not to gulp the cool liquid until you were a sloshing pool inside. But no, it wasn't right. On our way into Pawling, we were stopped by a kindly pair of photographers who made efforts each year to photograph passing through hikers and collect snapshots, not only of their faces, but also of their lives and motivations. They were a delight to meet, and we posed happily before immediately making for Tony's Deli, another famous trail spot for hikers. Tony's New York Deli had everything you could imagine an Italian deli should contain. The selection of hoagies, bagels and wraps making my head spin. But more than this, Tony let hikers camp in the triangular patch of grass next to his store. It wasn't a haven of peace. The triangular patch was hemmed in by the store car park on one side, the highway along another, and the final edge lined with train tracks for the regular New York line, which was to continue through the night, parping its horn from at least a mile away until it was at least a mile past. But we didn't care. Well, we didn't care at the time, when we were desperate for a Philly cheesesteak roll and four cans of cider in a heatwave. But we did care at 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. and 3:30 a.m., but we made it through. Tony's had provided taps and sockets outside for us to freely use. Such kindness. And it was an easy stroll inside in the morning to the bathroom and another delicious round of food with coffee. Off we set again, this time Wag and I together. Within half a mile we were up in the hills again, the road far behind. I loved hiking with Wag for many reasons, but a big one was her pure honesty about sometimes hating the hills and the exhaustion. I didn't have to pretend to be anything other than what I was around her, nor she around me. We'd hooted ourselves regularly, as after committing to powering up huge slabs of elevation without distraction, we'd see each other stopping and sneaking out the gut hook app to see how far we'd come and how far there was to go. This was totally counter to our talk of just getting our heads down and pushing through like others seemed to do. Usually, we'd only gone about 0.2 of a mile, which made us cackle. Eventually, we just decided to measure all hard things in 0.2 of a mile. "We can do it," she'd holler at me, grinning. "We can do anything hard for 0.2 of a mile." And so, through rainstorms, skinned knees, droughts, and endless ascents, we found no shame in bemoaning them together and then powering through, 0.2 miles at a time. Smart, kind, and accepting, she was a trail partner I was grateful to have. She'd recently graduated, and I soaked up her words and wisdom about how she had experienced life so far. I understood that the world she was stepping into was vastly different to when I had been her age. In fact, I had been exactly her age, sitting on that train many moons ago, reading Bill Bryson and wondering how I'd one day step foot on this very trail. How would life be for her at my age, having experienced such radical freedom and awe in nature at the very beginning of her road? I could only imagine the benefits, but also difficulties, of approaching a traditional working life for the first time after living in the wild this way. But perhaps there was no traditional for this generation, and maybe that was no bad thing. Close to the top of the steady climb, we smelled smoke and saw vague billowy wisps in the air ahead when there were no people. A campfire that someone had set and left smouldering in a forest clearing. We poured some of the little water we had on it, hard to spare in drought. And both of us spoke angrily about the negligence of those not checking embers were out before they hiked away. Wag melted her pole basket, trying to ensure the coals were done, and swore heartily before we hiked along to find and hug the biggest and oldest oak on the whole trail, a truly majestic wonder to see. The heat continued. We dipped in lakes that were alleged to be nuclear, took side trails to find rivers that weren't there, and guzzled more bottles left at roadsides for us. The draw to water was too much to bear, and before we crossed the Hudson, we slipped down to Canopus Lake, for a Nero day of swimming, volleyball, and drinking sodas with regular folks. After that, onwards to one of the most incongruous points of the entire trail, the AT Blue Blaze that went straight through the centre of the Bear Mountain Zoo after crossing over the Hudson River. The zoo had begun as a bear den in the 20s and was now a place for rehabilitating animals of every stripe. It was not only the zoo, which was interesting enough, that piqued our interest. On the far side of the Pens, before we started up Bear Mountain, was an outside swimming pool, which hikers had free access to. We duly lined up, a line of stink, and they let us descend to the poolside. Such crystal clear water in the dappled sunlight, with the sounds of the zoo animals baying and screeching in the trees around us. Such a travesty for regular folks enjoying their wholesome day at the pool, I'm sure, to watch us hikers peel off our filthy layers, pretend our pants and bras were bikinis, or trunks, and all jump in together to play and swim for a few hours. This trail was never not surprising. Hot days gave rise to night hiking over the following week, along side trails to other lakes and stepping around tourist bins at national parks which had been broken open by confident bears seeking discarded burgers and fries. We homed in on park facilities in the early mornings or late at night, attracted by the glow of vending machines plugged in, desperate for a soda or an iced lolly. Wag and I took a few winding routes through this patch of trail, exploring and experimenting with different blazes and roads until we joined the Bottle Cap Trail, which delivered us, after stepping over hundreds of the tiny orange salamanders we had been seeing more and more of, to our matriarch, the AT, and the tightest rock alley of them all, the Lemon Squeezer. My lemons squeezed, and pack held sideways over my head despite my 16-pound weight loss by this point, we were out and moving to the next border, New Jersey, a state no one was looking forward to because of all of the images of suburbs and industry that it threw up in our minds, but which was to give us some of the most beautiful trails of all. New Jersey, 72.2 miles. Chapter 15. The Unbearable Pain of Shedding a Skin. The humidity was still crazy, but we were all buoyed up on our massive ice cream sundaes from the famous creamery the night before, and to top it off, we'd called for delivery pizzas to our tents pitched by the road. Slightly sugar hungover, I left camp later than the others that morning. The heat was still relentless. Hey! I'm dropping this here. Better get it before the bears. My wake-up call was from Chimney, dropping off cold slices for me before he pieced out of camp. Wag headed out next, and then I was last. I never minded being last in, but hated being last out. On the map, the path looked straight and flat in terms of elevation, but it was an unnecessarily rocky scramble, deliberately rooted up and over every rocky outcrop in sight. I frightened the life out of a Nobo hiker who thought I was a bear coming and so had started singing and capering in the path to frighten me away, until I rounded the corner and we both collapsed into hoots of laughter. Ursines did make an appearance later, as a baby bear fell out of a tree to my right and then, looking stunned and sheepish, scampered off into the brush. These baby bears aren't so good at balance just yet. The crew caught up with and overtook each other in succession, each finding the others sprawled in the dirt at various junctures, desperate for water and squirting pure Mio electrolytes into our mouths with only the merest swig of precious water to see it down. Delirium was close, but so was the famed drive-in movie theatre in New Jersey, which welcomed hikers and let them stay for free at the back of the movie field, with free speakers thrown in too. A few of us scored a hitch into town, and I hit the local chiropractor. My pain was acting up badly because of dehydration and the inflammation it was causing. My sleep was so poor in these hot and thirsty nights. The streams were barely brown trickles, and no one was feeling good. I hitched back out to the movie field after resupplying with Wag and found some of the vortex there, so pitched up and listened to a bubble of nobos trash-talking us sobos and warning us that we wouldn't be able to handle the trail in Pennsylvania. We listened and smiled as usual, knowing they had New Hampshire and Maine to tackle. So, whatever, fellas. The lights of the ticker tape flashed all night long and interrupted what I had hoped would be a good rest. Few hikers had their rain fly on, as the heat was so intense, and so walking to the bathrooms in the restless night afforded me a bird's eye view into tents. Under the flickering neon, they looked more like they belonged to festival goers than to a group of hikers, with scattered beer and cider cans, pizza boxes and other junk. I didn't like the disrespect, and was glad later in the day when the nobos left and we cleaned around. I knew there was another reason I wasn't sleeping well. Buckshot was closing in on us, and I was hoping so hard that when he finally caught us up, things would be the same as they were before. But I knew, deep down, in the dread knot I carried in my gut, that he was going to be different. His messages had thinned out. His replies were weak. There was no reason I could think of other than he was camping on a tiny island out of Maine with his family, but I had made enough excuses for shit men in my life to know when I was clutching at straws. A reckoning was coming, and I only hoped I was wrong about how it was going to pan out. He was too important to me to lose, and I felt like I'd been treading water until he returned. Silly girl. But why worry, G? He's just a guy. One who behaves pretty damn selfishly, too. Wag was good at advice. Wise for her 21 years. It's not just that, I know that. I felt my cheeks flush. I was 41 damn years old. How could I be feeling like this about some 25-year-old wild man who was so undomesticated as to need to spend most of his life alone in the mountains and out under the stars? I think really he means so much to me because of how much he let me be me. How much he held space when I told him things, didn't judge me for struggling, taught me how to thrive out here when I would have given up, made me feel so alive and excited through it all. She nodded. He's like a portal, I thought. I walked through him with all my fear, and I didn't die from it. I came through it to the other side, and then was in some way cleansed of all the shame I had been carrying. And to keep up with him, to feel validated by someone so strong and bold, it put my sickness into a tiny corner of my identity, instead of filling my whole nest like an interloping cuckoo. That's why. He is the tie tethering me to my new identity. And if he leaves, then maybe that leaves too. Who are we, anyway? A reflection of those around us? It was easy to feel like myself when I was surrounded by my own cocoon of books and artwork, clothes that spoke for me, plans and events that sculpted who I was or wanted to become. But here on the trail, these things don't matter. They are of no currency. Here, the fierce, the famous, the rich, or the impoverished all coexist in anonymity, meaning there is no you other than the one you are when stripped naked. I was waking up to the fact that I had been too scared to be naked, and as I stripped bare and gave away the place I'd carved in the world, I'd not had the courage to stay exposed. I'd kept myself shielded with people who reflected who I wanted to be, but without doing the work first. Strong Buckshot, funny Dozer and Lazy Bean, kind Wag, experienced and confident Moose and Granola. Even when some of these people were unkind or unfriendly, I hadn't peeled myself away from them. And now I saw that it wasn't because I wanted them. It was that I was too afraid to see who I was and to be truly alone. The dread in my stomach over the past few days anticipating Buckshot's return told me it wasn't going to be long before I found out who I was. That night, after our 0.5, we barreled into the cidery over the street from the drive-in and were now seated in the hot, humid darkness. New friends from the drive-in, Maple and Cruz, were now in our gang. We were chatting and laughing under fairy lights that hung around the bowers, drinking flights of cider and discussing their curious ingredients. Looking between the smiling faces of my friends, I saw him. On the road, moving in the dim light from the field towards the supermarket. He was here, and he hadn't let me know. He knew I was here, and he didn't care. My gut was right. It was over, and this was how I was getting the news confirmed. I stood and forced a grin for the crew. Hey guys, I'm just going to get something from the store before it closes. Feeling fevered and angry, I knew that walking over there was a bad idea, but was unable to stop myself, or the fury. He was a liar. He had used me for my ability to pay for food, book hotel rooms, sleep with him, and make him laugh. I knew we weren't together, knew now he had a girlfriend, but I truly believed we were friends. I felt grief-stricken. Maybe the things I'd told him about myself had made him dislike me. Maybe he'd had time to think about my tears, my fear, and my weakness, and he didn't want to speak to me again. Maybe I was the girl I thought I was. Weak. Lamed by my dark years. I had thought he had seen through the light and the dark to the real me inside. But I knew I was only angry at myself for not loving myself enough. Not at him for not loving me. He had only ever been an exciting distraction, and now it was being torn away in front of me, and I knew I'd have to face myself at last. I hustled over the road in the dark heat, knowing it was wrong, that I was erring into the space of losing control and wanting more than I had. I should have sat in my feelings and let them ebb. But instead, I was propelled towards this man, hoping he could quiet the fears, but knowing he would not. And, lo, I picked up some snacks and knew that I would somehow bump into him, that the universe would ping us together around a corner or by some food stand. I was so busy wondering how it would happen that when it actually did, I was taken aback with a start. "Appalachian Gale, how the hell are you?" He stood back and appraised me, eyes taking off my clothes, grinning louche and large.
"Hell, you're looking good. I hope you've been well."
And he hoisted a 24-pack of beer onto his shoulder and turned slowly, going about his business, crudely intimate but so deeply detached.
"Hey," I managed, grinning and trying for nonchalant. "How was the trip?" "A while ago now, hey."
My fingers were gripping my sleeves with a pinching ferocity, but I kept my face relaxed.
"Yeah, you know, I've been catching up with y'all, haven't I? Phew! I fucking walked so many miles so quick, and this heat is fucking terrible. Here with Cap and Kate. All good? Getting the beer. Where are you staying?"
He looked the question at me, faux innocently. "The same place as you, buckshot." I was getting pissed off. We knew each other too well and too intensely for this polite howdy bullshit. "But you'd know that because I told you about this place like 2 days ago."
Yeah, that's true.
He was high and drunk already, but I was just noticing. He was good at hiding it until it got profound.
"Okay, yeah. Well, maybe I'll see you up there later. Where are you at now?"
"At the cidery over the street," I said, gesturing. "Wag, too. Come over if you like." Ugh, I was a fool. My mouth opened before my brain engaged gear way too often.
"Nah, maybe later. Gotta get this crate back up to the crew."
Grinning again, so humiliated, so let down. We used to be a crew, he and I. We liked joining others for a while, but we were having great times. Not any more, it seemed, and it was unbuttoning my chest. I nodded and explained that I needed to pick up a few more things, moseying off down the aisle as if I didn't care a bit. We ended up at the checkouts at the same time and spoke again, which is when he said,
"Oh, hey, Gail,"
and gestured over to me. Thrilled, but keeping my shit together, I slowly made my way over after I was done packing.
"Yep,"
I said, knowing he was going to ask when I was leaving or what my plans were. He looked down at his still-open wallet from paying the cashier.
"Here, the $100 you lent me.
and he tossed the money into the bottom of the checkout bin towards me and started to pack up.
Cheers!
Not even looking up. I didn't know how to process how that felt. Cheapened, paid off, a termination of our friendship by the swift closure of something owed. Done. Invoice paid, no comebacks.
Great!
I snapped. My tone and face made it clear I was fucked off, and his then flashed with the irritation of a man who's realised he's been an asshole and doesn't want to be held accountable for it. We were walking together through the doors to the outside when I blurted, "What the hell is going on?"
"What do you mean?"
This isn't the same. It's weird. It feels off. Like, what's happened?" He rolled his eyes and stopped walking to look at me.
"What do you mean, man? Nothing's weird."
He fixed me with a hard stare.
"At least, it wasn't until you just made it weird. But yeah, it sure feels weird now, don't it?"
"But that's not fair, Buckshot. I thought we were friends. I don't understand why you can't treat me like a friend rather than someone you barely know. We don't need to be more than friends. I know you can't, but don't come back and be an arsehole to me."
"Fuck's sake, Gail, everything's fine."
And he turned on his heel and walked up the road into the darkness, with only the white lettering from the pack of beer on his shoulder visible, bobbing up and down as he got further away. I was so angry with myself for losing control and just made it back to the cidery before I dissolved. Maple, aghast, followed me to the bathroom, sure that someone had died or I was losing my marbles. I filled him in, he hugged me close, and Wag came to join us. The ridiculous cliche of it all was just making me feel more humiliated, and I fought to control myself. There was no sleep that night. I gave up on the group drinking and carousing around the tents. Buckshot was in the middle, rolling joints and smoking his pipe, egging on the others around him to shoot beers, crushing and throwing them to the ground all around the semi-sleeping hikers. I lay in my tent and listened, tears coursing down my cheeks into puddles in the baffles of my thermarest. I was no longer fit for purpose as an adventurous duo. I no longer had someone to help define my worth. I was on my own, and it felt like the end of the world. Little did I know, it was to be the beginning of stepping into my own. Chapter 16. Moving on. Over the next few days, I dragged ass, falling behind the crew on purpose to cry and not have anyone see me. I wasn't only sad and humiliated, but also adrift. I was accepting the situation, but also realizing it had cut me loose, which as I walked and cried, I realized could be interpreted as both a good thing and a bad thing. We passed plenty of people on the trail over these warm, summery days. Sometimes the day hikers overwhelming us with the sweet smell of their washing powders and cologne. At New Jersey's highest point center, we got our free soda and hung about in good spirits, charging our devices inside and dodging disapproving looks from some staff. We chatted to some fun nobos in the sunshine and petted their dogs, admired their flamingo shirts, and swapped intel on cool places to go and shelters to avoid. They were taking it slow, sun-dappled and laughing unhurriedly, talking about hiring a guide to summit Katahdin in the winter so they didn't have to rush for the October deadline, and how they thought it would be more fun with ice axes than poles. We were supposed to push all the way to the fire tower for the night, but my crying and overthinking had me exhausted. So when I got to the Mashupakon shelter and saw Wag and Maple chilling, we psyched each other out of hiking further, and after some debate, we decided to stay. Just then, Chimney and his girlfriend Lauren showed up, making it clearly the right decision in the eyes of the universe. So, in such good company, we laughed and capered about in the clearing and shared food. A group of older men showed up and camped. They were clearly snorers, so I was damn delighted they didn't stay in the shelter. They had a chicken-of-the-woods mushroom that they had harvested, cooked, and brought round for us to try, insisting that it would all be fine. They looked so respectable, like they could be your dad, and so encouraging. So we all had a tiny piece, and it did taste like chicken. And then I remembered some horror film I'd once watched about drugging travellers and covertly Googled symptoms of mushroom poisoning on my one-bar phone connection as the men cackled and told us they didn't know what it was they'd really given us and asked if we'd all started hallucinating yet. Such droll gents. Because I'm so suggestible, I was sure my lips were swelling, and I was seeing things up until something else grabbed my attention. Luckily, just then, Maple asked me to test out his hammock, and all mushroom-related worries were forgotten in an instant. Here are some things that can hurt you in a forest. Things you think will hurt you. Mountain lions, bears, rattlesnakes, crazy people, poisonous berries, and fungi. Things more likely to hurt you. Ticks, hypothermia, getting lost, falling down things, and post-trail depression. Later, amid deep guttural snores from across the clearing, I tried to sleep. I was recognising that Buckshot had helped me more than I could have dreamed anyone would. He didn't have to. He'd taught me things, built my confidence, and held space for me to unravel. And I paid for it all with a piece of my heart. And that was okay. He might have felt important to me, but he was maybe just the pebble that had rolled away from me, releasing the avalanche behind. And that's what I was facing through these days of deep grief. The woods, the silence, the loneliness. I was sitting alone in my head, whilst all the rocks from my life tumbled about me as I walked. I could duck away from the rolling rocks and step off trail, distract myself with travel or people, beer or reasons to leave, but the rocks would always be there, and I'd always be running. I needed to let them fall, and take the hits until the path finally cleared. Without Buckshot, I didn't have to be reliant on anyone. I was stronger, and now that he'd gone for good, I was more aware of my progress, of all the things I'm not scared of that I had been, and had carried on being when he was there because I didn't have to face them. I now didn't need my tent next to anyone else's, or to sleep right next to someone. I didn't feel like animals were going to come in the night. I didn't panic about going further or not as far as other people. I could be more autonomous and confident about having some control and making my own plans for the day. He always threatened to go, and that made me anxious. Now he'd gone. And through my sadness, I felt some small measure of relief. I didn't have to find the courage to strike out alone now, because the decision had been made, and I could feel myself rising to the glorious challenge of experimenting with how I liked to do things on my own, rather than waiting for who I had thought was my partner to catch up. Pennsylvania. 229.6 miles. Chapter 17. Between Rocks and Hard Places. We had left the Delaware Water Gap Church Hostel on the PA border and were having the greatest time. I'd been introduced to Lizzo by my beloved Maple, and we were singing our hearts out on ridgelines and under the trees. It felt like Lizzo had been inserted into my life at just the right time, with me especially loving belting Truth Hurts out at the top of my lungs in my own personal broken-hearted revolt. Maple was sympathetic and supportive, a special man in every way, but he was also very interested in choreographing a Lizzo music video tribute of us all twerking on mountaintops, practicing for this. Was an excellent way to keep us all laughing, especially now we were in Pennsylvania, often referred to as Rocksylvania, through the gritted teeth of weary North Bounders. Voted the 14th best state, of 14, on the whole trail by hikers everywhere, throughout time immemorial, it was the state we'd all been warned about since Katahdin. And it was now here. What could be so bad? It was relatively flat, so little elevation. The views were fine, and the people were kind. But the rocks. The rocks. If you gathered 10,000 great white sharks, asked them to lie side by side for 150 miles of the PA trail, and open their mouths so you could walk across their teeth, it might be less sharp and painful than the reality of the trail in northern PA. We often ended our days in tears, feet pulverized and too tender to touch. It was relentless. And if the sharp, toothy stones weren't enough, then the edges of rocks would weigh in too, as if sharpened on purpose. Any mild grazing of a hip or thigh against a rock would bring a sharp bite and beads of blood. I had thought Maine to be like the Hunger Games. But I now believed that nothing had such a considered amount of jeopardy as PA. As though our tenacity was being tested by a constant upgrading of risk the deeper we entered the state. Rocks. Snakes in between rocks. Rattlers you could hear but not see. Copperheads basking under edges and ledges you couldn't predict with the next footfall. It was, of course, nothing so sinister as pre-planned danger, merely geological features and the nature that surrounded them. Boulder fields and sharp ridge lines that made the trail the diverse and beautiful adventure we loved. In fact, the second half of the state was beautiful and a blissfully easy roll through the rocks after the first half. It was in PA that I got to hike with Dawson again. I hadn't known he was called that when I braced myself next to him on the Vermont Bridge, or when I saw him defeatedly pack his bag and continue onwards. But now I did. A kind, quiet man who wrangled snakes and picked exotic teas in his real life in Florida, but who here on the trail was a mystery and enigma. Someone I was delighted to spend time with over the days that took us up to and over the precarious Lehigh Gap. Hikers divulge so much so quickly when you are in a rhythm with them, and our friendship was formed in hours and days as we pushed through this stretch. I was sad to see him go ahead, but knew we'd weave in and out with each other down the line. I needed a quick break, and so watched him hike on as I settled into some trail magic at the base of the gap. The vortex had concertinaed back together at the roadside for a night of beer and wine. And then we duly stretched out again the next morning toward Duncannon and the famous Doyle Hotel. We were 1,000 miles in. No mean feat. My daily mileage was increasing steadily again, even though the heat was punishing. And I was hoping to get to the fabled 30-miler in the coming days. Lots of us had already done 30 miles in a day. It wasn't as easy to reach it out here on the AT as it apparently is for other trails, such as the Pacific Crest Trail, which has longer, gentler ascents and descents. Here, on the AT, the elevation and descent and rocky, muddy trails are prohibitive. Even so, I was determined to get my body to do it. The day we hiked into Duncannon wasn't the day we were supposed to do it. We'd been a few days between towns and resupply, and we were all tired, fighting not just the heat, but also the animals. Snakes were popping up between rocks and crevices everywhere, and we needed to be on high alert for the rattling sound that would signal defensiveness and a potential strike. Also, the wasps. Wasps, hornets, who knew exactly what they were? But they made their nests on the flat ground of the trail, with just a small hole for their entry and exit. A small hole perfect for the tip of a pole to go down when a hiker walked by above. If the first hiker agitated the wasps without realizing, then the following hikers were the ones to walk through the angry swarms coming from the nest in protest, and it was never pleasant. We were all victims in turn throughout these days, but this day was the worst, I was stung on the back of my calf, and others were stung on their arms and face, and the wasps didn't let go, pinning themselves deeply into our flesh with fury beyond the initial injury. So it was, in the parching heat and pulling wasp barbs from our bodies in agony, we decided to push as hard as we could to get into Duncannon that night, and not early the next morning. It was going to be almost 30 miles, across PA's rocks, and running the gauntlet of flying beasts and tricksy snakes. I didn't know if I could actually make it. By late afternoon, I was done for. My calf had swelled large and deep red, my allergy to mosquito bites clearly not being exclusive. My feet hurt. My back hurt, and I was dragging my right leg again imperceptibly. I would have been happy to stop and camp at the shelter 2 miles from town, but the team encouraged me to continue. "Beer," Cruz said, smiling. "Beer and pizza!" "Hot, delicious pizza and the church basement to sleep in, gee! Town beer!" Wag knew just what to say. So, digging deep, I rallied and carried on. Hustling down a steep, long descent in the dim light under tree cover, I made a misstep, an error that everyone and anyone makes. I stumbled in my tiredness, and the cadence of my stride, which was fierce and powerful in the fast downhill motion, twisted off to the side. And then I watched in horror as my back foot swung forwards with the full force of a 4-mile-per-hour descent. Not forwards and onto the trail, but off trail at the angle my body had begun to stumble. Right into a huge rock on the side of the path. Plainly put, I kicked a goddamn boulder. Hard. With my soft trail runners. "Fuck it!" I yelled. The crew down ahead stopped and looked back up through the trees. "You okay, G?" Anxious faces below. Cruz and TJ checking in. Yep, just kicked a damn rock," I called back. "Damn, though, it really, really hurt." Well, no time to moan, so close to respite. I dug deep and hobbled on, knowing the burn in my foot would fade and keeping my mind off it by turning up my headphones. After the road walk into Duncannon, we set up in the church basement and then hit town to drink beer and eat pizza. I was constantly in awe of the church community along the trail. Always trusting, open-hearted and kind, with very little in the way of persuading people about their faith, just folks showing up for each other, being present and demonstrating such big hearts in the following of their principles. I was always very grateful. I lay on my mat amidst the other hikers on the linoleum floor of the basement. The day had been a success in the main, although at 29.4 miles, I couldn't count it as my first 30, which was very irritating, considering how much my foot hurt. The next morning, we decided to explore. First, the laundrette, then the store. And after that, mousse and granola got picked up by a fabulous older couple who loved to host hikers and had been scouting the roads in their truck for people to treat. They called us up and arranged where we'd meet, and we all dived into the back of their pickup, which would take us to their home. It was the best afternoon we could have wished for. A pool to swim in, fresh corn to shuck, and plate upon plate of homemade cooking and great conversation. As the sun dipped, the crew pulled themselves from their pool floaties and off loungers to be taken back into town. We piled out of the truck next to the legendary Doyle Hotel, originally built in the 1770s, and where Charles Dickens was purported to have made a visit. Our thirst sated at the bar, it was another night's rest, and then back to the trail again. This time, Cruz and I were out first and heading up the crew. Pennsylvania was to ease up on us after Duncannon. The rocks blunted a little, and the trails were gentle and flatter than previously. Perfect for my throbbing foot, which I was sure I'd badly bruised, and perfect for extended long days in succession. I debated with Cruz about why people don't manage to do long days and big miles, even if they want to. After discussing whether it was ultimately nutrition, physical health, or strength, we came to the conclusion that it was probably mostly mental. That people's bodies can do most anything asked of them, but people's minds will try to trip them up. Make a call. Scroll Instagram. Read that article. Take a break, etc. The mind is so good at making you believe you can't, so you just have to rewire that can't to can. Easier said than done. Longer days were becoming the norm, however, even with fun stops, like the half-gallon ice cream challenge at Pine Grove Furnace. I don't know how anyone can eat half a gallon of ice cream against a timer and then hike out, but Maple certainly did, albeit slightly green around the gills. The days blurred. I was happy in the company of Chimney, Cruz and Maple, the others slightly behind. Harper's Ferry over in West Virginia, the home of the Appalachian Trail headquarters and all things officially trail, was only a little further, and we were excited to get there. I'd pick up my packet of medication, sign the logbook, and have my photo taken for posterity for the special folder containing Polaroids of all the hikers who make it through. Some of our team had hung back, though, dipping into Washington, D.C. to see friends and the city, and were now revving up at the Mason-Dixon line at the edge of PA and Maryland, the border that marked the start of the four-state challenge, 42.9 miles in 24 hours. Hikers would sleep at the Mason-Dixon line, leave in the early hours and cross immediately from Pennsylvania into Maryland. Then 40.9 miles of Maryland would give over into West Virginia for only 6 miles, after which they'd step over the line into Virginia and collapse. It meant they missed the ATC in Harper's Ferry, but for some, it was worth it. Not for me, though. I was desperate for my codeine, having started steady withdrawal as my pills had run out in recent weeks. I'd noticed too late that this was having a detrimental effect on both my body and my mind. My legs twitched at night, my moods were erratic, my skin was itchy, and I was becoming gradually aware of how long and how deeply I'd become embroiled in a relationship with the medication and what a grip it had on my life. I was determined to get off it completely. But on a trail in the middle of the most challenging experience of my life so far from home, it didn't feel like quite the right time to go cold turkey. Maryland, 40.9 miles. West Virginia, 6 miles. Chapter 18. Short but sweet. Only 6 miles of trail, but West Virginia was a marker of note on the AT. It was not quite the exact physical halfway point of the trail, but it represented the psychological halfway point. This was because the town of Harper's Ferry, through which the trail wove, housed the headquarters of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. The ATC was the place where you had your photograph taken for their record books and received your hiker number, showing which number southbound hiker you were of those passing through this year. We hiked down into the town, excited to reach the central focus of the trail, and Harper's Ferry truly showed up for us. A beautiful town, with the welcoming Appalachian Trail headquarters holding parcels for me from my family. Plenty of coffee and snacks, and Polaroids for us all for posterity. I tore through parcels that had arrived with glee. There were some new shoes I'd sent forward to myself, as well as the parcel from home with a replenishment of my medicine. Thank goodness. Such a relief. Too much of a relief, I realised, just to know that I had the meds there in my pack, even if I was taking many less than before I started trail. It was clear that I had a deep dependency on codeine that I hadn't realised or accepted before this trip, both psychological and physical. I made a promise to myself right there to carry on weaning myself off them, and that for the next hike I tried to attempt, I wouldn't want to be taking them at all. Luckily, that was far off, because I had to finish this hike first. and knowing that I had a new stash of pills in case of a new pain surge was definitely reassuring. One more parcel to open. I wasn't expecting anything else, so it was a nice surprise. Inside were two pairs of socks and three packets of THC gummies. They'd been sent to me by a northbound hiker called Ding Dong, who I'd met the night I was deposited into the hostel at the bottom of Musiloki after my panic attack. She and her father had been so kind to me, and she had said she'd send something to Harper's Ferry for when I got there because it was a lovely feeling to get parcels along trail. She had wanted to give me something to look forward to. I was in such shock that evening that I hadn't properly computed and had only met her for that one night. And now here was this wonderful parcel waiting for me. The socks were perfect. The THC gummies were less so for me because I wasn't ever very good with smoking weed or feeling stoned. So I passed them out among those in the gang that wanted them and saved a few for myself to experiment with when the time felt right. After the excitement of the parcels, I sat back nestled deeply in a comfy sofa. It was here that I pulled out a few of the letters I had been carrying from the start of the trail. I hadn't thought about them much beyond feeling the warm hug of the knowledge that they were there in my pack, nestled in double Ziploc bags in a pouch between the frame and the pack itself. Letters I had asked for. As I was preparing to leave the UK for this journey, I knew there would be lows. Sometimes so low that I'd want to give up. It was for those times that I asked my loved ones to write to me, imagining a me with a grimy, tear-streaked face, having a meltdown and wanting to go, to run away from the challenge and give in. I asked them to write to that Gail, and to give her their best words of advice and encouragement for whatever it was I decided to do. And they had. I was carrying almost 20 letters in my pack that I had barely touched, never feeling that it was bad enough to warrant opening a letter. But now I wanted to see at least one or two to refuel my heart tanks, and to see who these people believed I could be now that I was almost halfway and had been through so much. Perhaps I could put some of them in my sock, and the love in them would heal my poor, throbbing foot. I focused, wondered which ones to read. Deciding I needed to know the message from He Who Said the Least, I plucked my father's letter from the pile. It was printed from the computer rather than hand.